Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. Peter Torelli, Falling Apart, by Rebecca Mackay. When Carlos asked why I would risk my whole career for Peter Torelli, I told him he had to understand that in those last 3 years of high school, Peter and I were the only two gay boys in Chicago. Because I really believed it back then, and 25 years of experience proving otherwise was nothing in the face of that original muscle memory. Me and Peter side by side on the hard pew during chapel, not listening, washed blind by the sun from the high windows, breathing in sync. It didn't matter that we weren't close anymore, I told Carlos. The point was, he'd been my first love. I'd never actually loved him, but still, listen, believe me, there's another kind of first love. It was during one of those long lectures or concerts or assemblies that Peter and I had discovered our common neurosis, the fear of magically switching bodies with the speaker or singer or priest and then having to improvise an exit. I would slide toward Peter on the pew, open a hymnal, and above, "A mighty fortress is our God," scribble in pencil, "Tuba player?" Peter would look up to the stage to watch the fat Winnetka sophomore puff his cheeks like a blowfish and write back, "Stop playing. No one misses a tuba." "First violin?" I wrote. "Feign a swoon," he'd write back. And then he'd mouth it to me, relishing the ooh of swoon. We joked about this fear, but really I think it bothered us both, this idea that we might suddenly be thrust in front of our peers and examined. It doesn't take a psychotherapist to figure out why. Peter later claimed the whole reason he became an actor was that the only way he could enjoy a play was from the inside. Everyone else knew it was his looks. I hadn't understood until we were 16 what it meant to turn heads. I'd considered it a figurative expression. But when we stood in line at Manny's or walked down Dearborn toward the bus, he was a human magnet. He was the North Pole. The girls at school would feel his sweater and tug his necktie. He said he had a girlfriend back east, that she was Miss Teenage Delaware, and everyone believed it. How could he not be on stage with that dark, sad face, that ocean of black hair, those sarcastic eyes? By the time we graduated, he'd done 2 seasons of professional summer stock. I was the varsity soccer goalie, and he was a movie star walking among us. When we sat together in chapel, we looked like the kings of the school, and nobody knew any different. And then the next day, we were 38 years old, and Peter fell to pieces. During a matinee of Richard III, in the middle of the second act, my friend abruptly and forever lost the ability to act. He said later it was something about the phrase, "jolly, thriving wooer," the strangeness of those words as they left his mouth, the pause a second too long before Ratcliffe entered. Since Peter told me all this, I've read the page 20 times in my Signet Classic, which is how I know that Peter's next line, as Richard, was, "Good or bad news that thou comest in so bluntly?" It was a line he'd have made foul jokes about backstage. "And I said it," he told me, "but it came out in this voice, like all the costumes had fallen away, like I was some kid in 8th grade English, and I had to read my poem out loud. It was just me, and there was no character, no play, just these words I had to say. You know our whole thing about leapfrogging into someone else's body? It was like that, but like I suddenly leapfrogged into myself." He said he could see each face in the audience, every one of them at once, smell what they'd eaten for lunch. He could feel every pore of his own skin and the ridiculous hump strapped to his back. Backstage, they knew something was wrong even before he started to shake. By the end of the next scene, the understudy was dressing. Peter told me this the next week over lunch. Actually, he told me many times over many lunches in the following year, as if through the retelling he could undo something. We met every other Thursday at the Berghof, where he'd have root beer and I'd have 2 pale ales, and we'd both eat enormous plates of bratwurst and chicken schnitzel and noodles with butter sauce. We had set these lunches up 2 years earlier, very formally. We'd been in and out of touch for ages when we found ourselves alone on the living room futon of a boring party in Hyde Park, drunk, wondering aloud if knowing each other when we had acne was a reason we'd never dated as adults.
We had kissed just once, sophomore year, when we stayed behind after a SAD meeting to pick up the leftover flyers. I didn't know he was gay. I hardly knew I was. He came over with the green flyers in a stack as if to hand them to me, but when I took hold of the papers, he pulled them back and me with them. The only person I'd ever kissed before was a girl named Julie Gleason. Afterward, he said, "You're pretty dense, aren't you?" That was it. We didn't talk for 2 weeks, and then we were best friends again before the paper cuts on my palm had even fully healed. I had looked at him that night at the party, beautiful and grown up, with a beer bottle sweating against the leg of his jeans, and said, "I never see you anymore." He said, "Yes, I'm slowly becoming invisible." Peter was a kind of guy who would try for any joke, any chance to flash his perfect orthodontia. Even when it wasn't funny, you had to appreciate the showmanship. And then he looked at me seriously, which was rare at the time. "We should get together and talk. I mean regularly, because I miss you. It would be like therapy. I should have known I would always be the therapist." I told him once that he was the Gatsby to my Nick Carraway. He flashed his teeth and said, "Yes, but I throw much wilder parties." And like stupid little Nick, I ended up trying to fix things. If I hadn't spent American Lit distracted by Zach Moretti and his amazing forearms, I might have registered that these stories never end well. Let me say, Peter had been brilliant. Chicago breeds its own stage stars who stay local even if they're good enough to go to New York, and he was one of them. When I saw his Hamlet at Chicago Shakespeare, all memories of Mel and Lord Larry vanished in a celluloid fog. He was the right age, the right build, and those eyes could turn like lightning from irony to terror. I wonder how that colored our friendship, that I saw him simultaneously as Peter and Hamlet. If nothing else, it made me more tolerant of his ramblings and neuroses. After the night he froze up, the night of which we shall not speak, he called it, whenever he spoke of it, which was constantly, he took sick leave for a week, then tried again. If anything, he was worse. He quit before they could fire him and spent the next 2 months looking for work. He walked into each audition knowing everyone in the room had heard about his big dry-up. It couldn't have helped. A few months later, Peter moved to southern Wisconsin and took a job doing dinner theater, and our lunches became less frequent. In late November 2005, almost a year after the night of which we tended to speak obsessively, we sat near a window in the Berghof and watched the year's first snow collect in the street. He told me about his new role as Bob Cratchit in something called Let's Sing a Christmas Carol. The director wanted British accents from everyone. Peter could do a perfect one, of course, but not without sinking further into the hollow cadences, the glazed eyes, the strangling sense of the ridiculous. "Most of them sound southern. It's terrible," he said. He was on caffeine or something worse. He was literally bouncing on the springy seat of the booth. The 11 o'clock number is, I shit you not, called God Bless Us Everyone. Jesus Christ, you should hear it. It sounds like Scrooge drops by terror for pecan pie. Every time I saw him, he talked faster, as if he were running out of time. He still flashed a smile, but perfunctorily, as if displaying his incisors for the dentist. When our food came, he finally asked me a question so he could stop talking and eat his schnitzel. How's life in Phonathon land? Are you giving away thousands of tote bags? I worked in special events for NPR, and for several years before we officially reconnected, Peter and I would run into each other in the restaurants of the monstrous tourist trap on Navy Pier where Chicago Shakespeare and Chicago Public Radio both live. Once, after we'd drifted apart for a few months, our lunch parties at Riva joined together, and when someone introduced us and said we might hit it off, we started laughing so hard Peter dropped his wine glass. "We're doing better than last year," I answered. "I've been telling everyone in the land of Moo about the Republicans trying to shut you down. I'm going to assemble an army of cheeseheads for your defense." "Thank you, Peter. That's thoughtful." Peter started mixing all the food on his plate. Schnitzel, potato, cream, spinach, kraut. "So what about trying my shrink?" I said. "She's good. I wouldn't lie to you." The old Peter would have queued up his German psychiatrist impersonation, drawing the attention of everyone around us, but the new Peter just stared at his mixed-up food. "She might be good, but how far is she from Kenosha, the epicenter of the theatrical world?" "She's here in the city, and that would be good for you." He agreed to call her and then told me about his great-uncle, who, after undergoing electroshock, became obsessed with licking copper objects. I wanted him to ask about me, to ask about Carlos, who was moving out of my apartment in gradual increments and breaking my heart in painful slow motion. I'd have to find someone else to complain to. "Listen, though," said Peter, "I'm on the mend. If I had more serious roles again, that might do it. I mean, I was never a comedian, and that's what they're asking me to do." As much as I didn't believe his optimism, I was glad he wasn't giving up. I constantly pictured him hanging himself from the closet rod of his cold little apartment, or drinking something medieval and poisonous. Maybe I just watched his Romeo too many times. "I've got an offer for you," I said. I'd thought about it in the car on the way there and decided I couldn't ask him. I decided it several times, in fact, but now here it was coming out of my mouth. "I want you to do some on-air work for me." He nodded, his eyes wide, as he mashed his food and listened to me explain the project. In cooperation with the Art Institute, we'd commissioned 20 local poets and authors to write short works relating to the museum's crown jewels, a mystery writer casting one of the little thorn rooms as a crime scene, a Pulitzer-winning poet extolling Picasso's Man with the Blue Guitar and Sonnet. The poems and stories would hang beside the art, and my job was to find actors to read them aloud at the gala opening and then record them for NPR and for the museum audio tour that people could rent with headphones. My brilliant idea had launched a 2-year nightmare of collaboration with the hateful little man I'd come to call Institute Steve, and somehow I'd ended up in charge of the reading part. "It's December 30th if your show is done." "The thing is," I said, grabbing for the only available out, "the other actors might be people you knew." "People I know, Drew." His face stilled itself long enough to shoot me one of his complicated, devastating looks, part annoyance, part sarcasm, part glee that he'd caught me saying what I really thought. "I'll do it if you don't think I'd embarrass you." And so the Rubicon was crossed. He left with Dr. Zeller's business card in his pocket and both of our leftovers in styrofoam boxes. He was eating plenty despite his meager paycheck because he got free food at the dinner theater, but every night he had to choose between chicken a la king and Lake Superior whitefish. I stayed behind to pay the bill, and as I waited for the busboy to come back, I pressed my cheek to the dirty, cold glass of the window beside me. I felt like I needed to wake myself up. I had just risked my career on his ability to be Peter again, to jump back into himself, and I strongly doubted he could do it. The next time we met for dinner was before the Art Institute event. I had more important things to do, but I'd been in earlier to see that my interns were on task, and I wanted to make sure Peter was ready and calm. The Berghoff was right around the corner, and I knew neither of us would get a chance to eat the shrimp and strawberries at the reception. He'd been down a couple of weeks before to record at the studio, and I'd been relieved at how good he was, at least without an audience. I'd invited him over then for dinner with Carlos, who was still hanging around to see what further damage he could inflict on my psyche, but Peter had an audition in Milwaukee with the Kinnikinnick Players for the night of January 16th. He hadn't gotten the part. Tonight Peter looked skinnier and pale and had a soft stubble he might have been growing for insulation, the way he sat there in his coat and hat, his jaw shaking against the cold. To put it delicately, he looked like a few friends I had in the 1980s who are not with us anymore. I got the waitress to bring us some tea as soon as we sat down. He held the cup, letting it warm his hands, but didn't drink any. It was all over the news that the Berghoff would be closing in a couple of months. We stood outside in the cold for 40 minutes just to get a table. People around us were taking pictures, touching the menus as if they were the faces of dying lovers. "I went to your shrink," he said, "twice. You didn't tell me she was beautiful, like Juliette Binoche, and we're very optimistic." He was warming up enough to lay his woolly hat on the table. "Great," I said. I couldn't keep from staring at how his brow and cheekbones stuck out sharply from his face, how his skin stretched over them, shiny and translucent. He went on and on about the therapy, about opening himself up to pain, about finding his core. I barely listened. "So how's Carlos?" he said once we ordered dessert. It was too late in the meal, and he was too far behind on the story. "Not great, but you know," I said, confident he didn't care enough to press further. To be safe, though, I changed the subject. I said, "So I had a dream about the Berghoff last night. I was running around downtown trying to give everyone vitamin shots because of this disease I'd exposed them to. It was wartime with tanks in the streets, and if people didn't get these shots, they were going to die. I had to find everyone I ever slept with and get them to come to the Berghof to get this shot. So I'm knocking on doors, and people have moved, and by the time I find Carlos, he tells me he won't take the shot. He'd rather die. He's lying there in the snow, dying, and he goes, "You can't save them all, Drew." And I woke up screaming. I mean, what the hell is that? "Dreams don't mean anything," he said. "I used to believe they did, but they really don't. Random synapses." As I signed the bill, he dug into his apple tart like someone just rescued from the wilderness, his eyes wide with the wonder of sugar and crust. He chewed so fast it looked like his teeth were chattering. He gestured behind me with a jerk of his eyes, and I turned to look at the next table, pretending to get something out of my jacket pocket. I assumed he met the teenage girl with a roll of fat hanging over the back of her low jeans. She was with her parents. "What would you do?" he said. His mouth was full of tart. Sometime after high school, the game had evolved away from musicians and actors, and we, or at least Peter, had begun obsessing about leaping into regular people's lives, about how to fool their families. I was tired of it after 25 years, but this wasn't the day to put him in a bad mood. "Okay, pretend to get sick so I don't have to go to school and spend the whole time doing aerobics. I could get 15 pounds off at least. Do I get to be myself again after?" "Presumably." Then I finished reading Proust. Peter took a sip from his root beer, and I noticed his hand shaking. I wondered briefly if it was Parkinson's, if the whole personality shift was that easy to explain. But Peter was such a hypochondriac, he'd have thought of that already. "You're so fucking boring," he said. "I'd run that fat little ass right into the street right now and see if I could stop traffic. I'd see how many laws I could break." "You could do it right now," I said. "You could run out there and just ruin your life. Nothing's stopping you." He put his napkin on his plate and stood up. I thought that's what the museum was for. As we entered the front doors of the Art Institute, the last regular museum visitors of the night were bundling past the stone lions and out into the cold. "Did you ever read that book when you were a kid?" Peter said as he walked through the emptying halls. "The one where the kids run away and live in the Met?" "And they bathe in the fountain," I said. "That's my new plan. I want to camp out under some dinosaur bones and just..." He let his sentence trail off as if the suits of armor we were passing would explain the rest. I imagined them as 100 failed geniuses hiding behind the glass, starved down to thin, steel exoskeletons. They knew what he meant. We stopped at the Chagall windows, stood for a moment in the warmth of their thick blue light, then headed into the special exhibit hall. I left Peter staring at a messy clay while I talked to Lauren, my boss, who had hated the idea of this event from the time I brought it up 2 years before, and was waiting for everything to fall apart. Her overplucked little eyebrows arched up her forehead as she asked me why half the writers weren't there yet. I went to check on the champagne, and once the evening started moving, I lost track of Peter among the tablecloths and microphones and whining interns, and finally among the rush of people in coats. Half were Art Institute supporters with vintage bracelets or Frank Lloyd Wright neckties, and half were NPR junkies with professor haircuts. Some might have been both, God bless them. I knew I should have introduced Peter to the other actors, told him where to be, but leaving him alone was my small way of shaking him by the shoulders, of telling him to grow up. When I saw him again, he was talking to one of the actresses he knew from Chicago Shakespeare, a woman who just returned from off-Broadway and chopped her hair short. She was laughing at something he said, and he was teetering back and forth on his feet, as if he might at any second lose a lifelong battle with gravity. He was laughing, too, but the way his skin stretched on his jaws, he looked deathly. I took the microphone and welcomed everyone, but my voice could never command a room. People still milled and talked and jostled for position. I introduced the 5 actors, and it wasn't until they came and stood beside me that I noticed Peter still had his puffy green coat on, his hands shoved down in his pockets. I wondered if he was punishing me for leaving him alone, or if he was so thin under there that he didn't want to frighten people. In high school, he would take his shirt off at every opportunity, claiming it was hot out at 60 degrees. I'd assumed back then that his dark skin was from Italian genes, but now I saw it must have just been the sun. The two other men were dressed in sleek sweaters, and the two women wore silk blouses and pants, audition outfits like Peter used to have dozens of. He looked now as if we'd found him on the street at the last minute. We started with the first painting, Caillebotte's Paris Street, Rainy Day, and the short-haired actress read a brief story by Stuart Dybeck called Rainy Day Chicago. When she finished, the crowd moved across the gallery to a tiny Picasso, where one of the men read a poem called Triangle Woman. We'd pulled a miracle, getting the Art Institute to move so many of its own crowd-pleasers into one exhibit. They'd wanted to highlight lesser-known works, things they would pull from some vault, but most of the writers had agreed to the commission only if they could choose the painting. We'd asked the writers to email us their wish lists, and Nighthawks topped almost every one. It was something about the loneliness, the coffee, the silence. Everyone wanted to lay private claim to that one desolate corner of the universe. In the end, no one got it because it was on loan in New York. How could this one object embody loneliness, I wondered, when people crowded shoulder to shoulder around it, shared it, traded it, paraded it around? If Hopper's little coffee counter was lonely, it was in the way a prostitute was lonely, or an actor. I had a hard time paying attention, and I stood there thinking how flat the readers all were, how little grace they showed compared to Peter in his prime. He played Edgar and Lear one summer up in Evanston, in the park by the beach. He was beautiful in a red shirt, and his voice made every line sound like something you'd been on the verge of remembering if you'd only had time. Peter's first reading was for my least favorite story, as well as my least favorite painting in the entire museum. A very young, way too hip fiction writer from Bucktown named Sam DeMar had emailed us that the only painting he felt like writing on was the one with the giant gum. I'd actually loved it as a child, that enormous pack of gum floating over the city skyline. Now I hated how the gum hovered there, out of proportion. It had nothing to do with the city below it, no shared color palette, the garish green wrapper rendering the brown skyline drab and uniform. On one of our first dates, Carlos and I had stood there joking that it was based on a true story, the giant gum crash of 72. Since then, I'd always thought of the gum as about to land, to flatten the unsuspecting workers below. So I'd found it particularly funny that the story Sam DeMar had submitted was called The Gum Flew Away. DeMar himself was standing there at the side of the room in dirty khakis, smirking at his wine glass. Peter pulled a tube of papers from his coat pocket and unrolled it so he could read the top one. The other actors held theirs in the black folders we'd sent them in. First, all the gum flew off, he read, leaving Chicago in its spearmint dust. Then the department stores floated away. Aside from the fact that his papers were visibly shaking, Peter sounded like himself, strong-voiced and in full control of the English language. This story suited his flat, ironic delivery. I'd chosen it for him specifically because it was monochromatic and free from dialogue. The hot dog stands were next, I heard him say. For all my daydreaming about finding myself stranded on stage, this was the closest I'd come to feeling as if it were my own energy propelling an actor, as if when I stopped focusing the whole thing would fall apart. Peter was gesturing around now, with still shaking papers, backing toward the wall and away from the old ladies in the front row. Even his legs were bouncing, and it finally occurred to me that maybe it was drugs making his limbs and voice and eyes jump around like that. It didn't seem like something he'd do, but who was I anymore to say what Peter would do? And then as he read the line about the mayor launching himself off the Hancock Tower, Peter actually put the back of his hand against the painting and swept it up the canvas. The gas from the crowd was so loud and so high that I couldn't tell where it stopped, and the alarm started. A security guard I'd barely noticed trotted from the room and another stepped forward, speaking into a radio. Peter froze, and I could feel his stomach flip. I could feel the sweat sticking the papers to his hand. The alarm was turned off, and people started talking quietly. "And this is why we didn't broadcast live," Lauren whispered beside me. She was glaring at me as if I'd done it myself. The Institute coordinators were talking in a cluster while two guards and a woman in a suit came hurrying in, asking Peter to step aside so they could inspect the painting for damage. The crowd just looked embarrassed, all touching their faces but waiting politely for the reading to resume. Sam DeMar seemed to find the whole thing hilarious. Peter had stepped aside, but he was still up there in front of everyone, the only movement coming from his eyes, which jumped around liquidly, looking for their chance to leap free from his face once and for all. One of the guards talked with him in what should have been a whisper, but everyone could hear. He asked for his name, his driver's license, copied everything down on a big clipboard. If the guard took any notice of the waiting audience at all, it was as an audience for his own fine performance. And I thought maybe that's what I would have done if I'd leapfrogged up there into Peter's body. If I needed to get away before anyone realized I was a fraud, I'd hit the painting and make the show stop. But Peter had his lines right there, and he knew what to do. It was a good 5 minutes before the woman in the suit stepped away from the painting and signaled that we could continue. She stayed there, though, in the corner of the room, frowning. I assumed she'd have a long night of paperwork ahead of her now, a lot of calls to make. I felt bad for her. I took the mic again and said, with a big fundraising grin, "Now you've seen what fine security your contributions support." Lauren was at the front of the crowd, shaking her head at me over and over to show how disappointed she was, as if I hadn't gotten the message yet. "We're going to try that one again." I waited for a meek laugh from the audience and then turned toward the actors. Peter looked at me with those blank, jumpy eyes. He hadn't done it on purpose, or at least he didn't think he had. He looked like he didn't even recognize me, like I was just another blurred member of his audience, watching and breathing and waiting for him to fail. I'm still not sure what I felt standing there. Maybe I felt my heart break, or maybe I felt Peter's heart break. When you've known someone that long, when you've formed yourself around his personality, back when you were just a 14-year-old lump of clay, isn't it really the same thing? Aren't his heart and your own somehow conjoined? Perhaps that's what I could never explain to Carlos. Ours was a kind of first love that wasn't aimed at each other, but somehow out at the world. We were forever side by side on the chapel bench watching the show. Peter whispered something to the short-haired actress and handed her his papers. He held up his open hands to the audience in apology, 10 pale, bony fingers, then walked around the people and out of the exhibit. "The gum flew away," the woman read, the clarity of her voice, a reassurance, a wiping away, by Sam DeMar. "First, all the gum flew off, leaving Chicago in its spearmint dust. Then the department stores floated away." I thought of following Peter out. I'd done it so many times before, chasing him down as he stormed from a party, calling his name 5 times until he finally turned to look at me, tear-streaked or red-faced on the wet sidewalk. "He didn't mean it," I'd usually say, or, "You're just drunk," or, "We all love you." I never said that I did. Just all of us, meaning everyone at the party, everyone he'd ever met, everyone who'd ever seen him from across the street. It wasn't true anymore. The world didn't love him, just I did, and I had the feeling that even if I could say that, it wouldn't be enough. And even if it were, then what? What would I do with that responsibility? And now Lauren, who was still my boss if I was lucky, was finally shooting me a look of conspiratorial relief. "Actors," said her face. "I know," said mine. It hit me like a wall of cold water that I wouldn't see Peter again, that he'd avoid my calls until he drifted to another city to try again and fail. Someone would hire him at a third-tier regional theater on the basis of his resume, and he'd last one show, if that. He probably wouldn't know how to give up. After the readings, I propped myself up at the microphone and said my bit about membership and shortening the pledge drive with early donations. An Institute Steve said something I couldn't follow in his nasally little whine, and I got a drink in my hand. It was cold enough outside that I wanted to drink so I wouldn't feel the bone chill on the way home. I chatted up as many people as I could stomach over the wine and shrimp. People didn't want to talk to me, though. What they wanted was to meet the actors, these instant small celebrities who had become important merely by commanding attention for 20 minutes and possessing nice faces. "I saw you in Phaedra at the court," the woman said to one of the actresses, who smiled graciously. "It was just gorgeous. You wore that red dress. Tell me your name again." Another woman asked the actor who'd read the Stuart Dybeck piece to sign her program. She didn't seem to notice Dybeck himself standing a few feet away, laughing with a friend and wiping his glasses on his tie. If the actor found the request strange, he didn't show it, signing his name on the margin of the paper. Peter would have written something like, "Peter Torelli is fabulous, Love and Kisses, Pablo P., or the old Peter would have, the one who knew magic. I felt the wine go to my head, and I felt relief that the whole thing was over. I drank more wine to shut out the suspicion that I was glad Peter had left. I got through the next hour and walked out into the cold, relieved to be drunk and half expecting to find Peter there on the sidewalk, 18 years old and scribbling in ballpoint pen on the knee of his khakis. He was gone, and there were just people waiting for buses and people waiting for taxis, everybody waiting to leave. It was like that after our kiss sophomore year, the way I stood frozen 30 seconds and then ran after him into the cold night, one of my duck boots untied, my left palm bleeding in parallel paper-cut stripes. He was gone, and I'd stood under the school's archway entrance looking to see his breath in the air, thinking it would tell me which way he went. I thought, if he ran back inside, I'll follow him and I'll kiss him again. If he got a cab, there's nothing I can do. He had found a cab that night, as he probably had now. Or maybe he'd slouched all the way down Adams, his parka blurring him into the frozen crowd, the crowd sweeping him onto the train shooting him up north and off the face of my earth. This is the way it happens. First my friend floats away, leaving Chicago in his dust. Then he leaves me, no breath above the concrete, no voice in the air to catch and hold so I can jump into him so I can steer him back. Then the Berghoff closes and the radio stations all shut down. The school chapel folds its benches and windows and flies away. The frozen sidewalks peel up like strips of gum. The skyscrapers drift like icebergs into the lake, up the St. Lawrence and out to sea. The citizens grab for something to save, but it's all too cold to touch. The mayor holds a press conference. We can't save it all, he says. In a month, they've all forgotten. Standing in the empty streets of their empty city, the people look up and say to no one in particular, something used to be here, something beautiful and towering that overshadowed us all, and it seemed very important at the time. And now look, I can't even remember its name. And that story was Peter Torelli, Falling Apart, by Rebecca Mackay, from The Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Sun Fiction International, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. Don't You Blame Anyone, by Julio Cortázar. Cold weather always complicates things a bit. In summer, you're so close to the world, skin against skin. But now at 6:30, his wife is waiting for him at a store to choose a wedding present. It's late, and he realizes it's cold. You've got to put on the blue sweater, just anything that goes well with the gray suit. Fall is nothing but putting on and pulling off sweaters, closing oneself in, keeping distances. Without really feeling like it, he whistles a tango while moving away from the open window, rummages for the sweater in the closet, and starts putting it on in front of the mirror. It's not easy, maybe because of the shirt that sticks to the wool of the sweater, and he has trouble forcing his arm through the hole. Little by little, his hand advances until at last a finger appears from the cuff of blue wool, but in the evening light, the finger looks wrinkled and bent inwards, like a black nail with a sharp tip. With one quick movement, he pulls his arm out of the sleeve and stares at his hand as if it were not his own. But now that it's outside the sweater, he sees it's just the same hand as always, and he lets it fall at the end of his limp arm. But it occurs to him that maybe it would be better to put the other arm into the other sleeve, just to see whether this way isn't easier. It doesn't seem so, because as soon as the wool of the sweater gets stuck to the material of the shirt, the lack of habit in beginning by the other sleeve makes the operation twice as difficult. And even though he's begun whistling once again to keep his mind occupied, he feels that his hand barely advances, and that without some complementary maneuver he will never succeed in getting it to reach the exit. Better to try all at once, bend the head down to bring it to the height of the sweater's neck, while introducing the free arm into the other sleeve, straightening it and tugging simultaneously at both sleeves and at the collar. In the sudden blue gloom that envelops him, it seems absurd to keep on whistling, and he begins to feel something akin to heat on his cheeks, even though at least part of his head should by now be outside. But the forehead and his entire face remain covered, and the hands are barely halfway up the sleeves. Hard as he might pull, nothing comes out into the open. And now it occurs to him that maybe he's made a mistake in that sort of ironic anger with which he started the task all over again, and that he has stupidly forced his head into one of the sleeves and one hand into the sweater's collar. If this were so, then his hand would have to come out easily, but even though he pulls with all his strength, he can't manage to advance either hand. But now, instead, it seems that his head is about to emerge because the blue wool tightens itself with almost irritating strength against his nose and mouth, stifles him more than he could possibly have imagined, forcing him to breathe deeply while the wool becomes wet against his mouth. It will probably run and stain his face blue. Luckily, at that very moment, his right hand comes out into the open, into the cold outside, and at least there's an outside even if the other hand is still trapped inside the sleeve. Maybe it's true that his right hand was inside the sweater's collar, and that's why what he thought was the collar is pressing so tight on his face, stifling him more and more, and the hand, instead, has been able to emerge easily. Anyway, just to be sure, all he can do is go on forcing himself through, breathing in deeply and letting out the air little by little, even though it's silly, because nothing prevents him from breathing perfectly except that the air he's gulping in is mixed with fluff from either the collar or the sleeve of the sweater. And there's also the taste of the sweater, that blue taste of the wool which is probably staining his face, now that the dampness of his breath mingles increasingly with the wool. And though he can't see it, because if he opens his eyelashes bat painfully against the sweater, he's sure that the blue is wrapping itself around his wet mouth, into his nostrils, over his cheeks, and all this fills him with anxiety, and he wishes he could once and for all put on the sweater, without even taking into account the fact that it must be late and that his wife must be getting impatient outside the store. He tells himself that the most sensible thing to do is to concentrate on his right hand, because that hand outside the sweater is in touch with the cold air of the room. It's like a sign telling him it won't be long now, and it can help him. It can climb up his back until it holds onto the sweater's waist with the classic movement which helps one put on any kind of sweater by pulling energetically downwards. Unfortunately, in spite of the hand feeling around on the back searching the woolen edge, it seems that the sweater is completely rolled up around the collar, and the only thing the hand can find is a shirt which is becoming more and more wrinkled, even dangling in part out of the trousers, and it's of little use to move the hand forward and try to pull at the sweater from the front, because on his chest he can only feel the shirt. The sweater must have barely passed his shoulders, and is probably there, rolled up and taut, as if his shoulders were too wide for this sweater, which really proves that in fact he has made a mistake, and that he has put one hand up the collar and the other hand up a sleeve, so that the distance from the collar to one of the sleeves is exactly half the distance of one sleeve to the other. And that explains his head being slightly bent to the left, on the side of the hand still imprisoned in the sleeve, if it is in fact the sleeve, and that instead his right hand outside can move about freely in the air, even though it hasn't managed to pull down the sweater still rolled up at the top of his body. Ironically, it occurs to him that if there were a chair nearby, he'd be able to rest and breathe more easily until he's managed to get the whole sweater on. But he has lost his sense of direction after having turned in circles so many times with that sort of euphoric gymnastics which initiates any putting on of an article of clothing and which has something of a surreptitious dance step, irreproachable in anyone's eyes because it responds to a utilitarian end and not to culpable choreographic tendencies. After all, the real solution would be to take off the sweater, seeing that he hasn't been able to put it on, and check the correct opening for each hand in the sleeves, and for the head in the collar. But the right hand carries on going and coming in a haphazard way, as if it were ridiculous to give up at this point, and once it even obeys and climbs up to the height of the head and pulls upwards without his understanding in time that the sweater has stuck to his face with the damp gluishness of his breath mingled to the blueness of the wool. And when the hand pulls upwards, it hurts as if something were ripping out his ears and wanting to tear out his eyelashes. More slowly, then, try using the hand inside the left sleeve. If it is the sleeve and not the collar, And to do that, help the left hand with the right hand so that the left hand can either go deeper into the sleeve or draw back and free itself, even though it's almost impossible to coordinate the movements of both hands, as if the left hand were a rat trapped in a cage and from outside another rat were trying to help it escape, unless instead of helping it were biting it, because suddenly the imprisoned hand hurts him, and at the same time the other hand grabs hard onto that which must be his hand which hurts him so much that he gives up trying to take off the sweater and prefers to make one last effort to push his head out of the collar and push the left rat out of the cage. And he tries by fighting with his whole body, leaning forward and then backwards, turning around in circles in the middle of the room. If he is in the middle of the room, because now he thinks that the window was left open and that it's dangerous to carry on turning around in circles blindfolded. He'd rather stop in spite of his right hand going and coming without paying any attention to the sweater, in spite of his left hand hurting more and more as if his fingers had been bitten or burnt. And nevertheless, that hand obeys him. Contracting little by little the lacerated fingers, he manages to grip through the sleeve the sweater's waist rolled up on the shoulder. He pulls downwards with barely any strength left. It hurts too much, and he would need the help of the right hand, instead of its useless climbing up and down his legs, instead of pinching his thighs as it's doing now, scratching or pinching him through his clothes without his being able to prevent it, because all his willpower is limited to his left hand. Maybe he has fallen to his knees, and he feels as if suspended by his left hand tugging once more at the sweater. And suddenly it's the cold on his eyebrows and forehead, on the eyes. Absurdly, he doesn't want to open his eyes, but he knows he's out. That cold substance, that delightful substance, is the open air, and he doesn't want to open his eyes. And he waits 1 second, 2 seconds. He allows himself to live in a cold and different time, the time of outside the sweater. He's on his knees, and it's beautiful to be like that. Until little by little he gratefully opens his eyes, freed from the blue spider's web of wool inside. He opens his eyes carefully and sees the 5 black fingernails hovering over his eyes, and he has just enough time to lower his eyelids and throw himself back, covering himself with the left hand, which is his hand. That is all he has left to defend him from inside the sleeve, to pull at the sweater's collar upwards, and the blue web is spun around his face once more while he picks himself up to run away someplace else, to reach at last some place without the hand, without the sweater, some place where there's only fragrant air to envelop him and accompany him and caress him, and 12 floors down. And that story was Don't You Blame Anyone by Julio Cortázar, translated by Alberto Manguel. From Sudden Fiction International, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. The next story is from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. The Anatomy of Desire by John Leroux. Because Hanley's skin had been stripped off by the enemy, he could find no one who was willing to be with him for long. The nurses were obligated, of course, to see him now and then, and sometimes the doctor, but certainly not the other patients, and certainly not his wife and children. He was raw, he was meat, and he would never be any better. He had a great and natural desire, therefore, to be possessed by someone. He would walk around on his skinned feet, leaving bloody footprints up and down the corridors, looking for someone to love him. "You're not supposed to be out here," the nurse said. And she added, somehow making it sound kind, "You untidy the floor, Hanley." "I want to be loved by someone," he said. "I'm human, too. I'm like you." But he knew he was not like her. Everybody called her the saint. "Why couldn't it be you?" he said. She was swabbing his legs with blood retardant, a new discovery that kept Hanley going. It was one of those miracle medications that just grew out of the air. "I wasn't chosen," she said. "I have my skin." "No," he said. "I mean, why couldn't it be you who will love me, possess me? I have desires, too," he said. She considered this as she swabbed his shins and the soles of his feet. "I have no desire," she said. "Or only one. It's the same thing." He looked at her loving face. It was not a pretty face, but it was saintly. "Then you will," he said. "If I come to know some time that I must," she said. The enemy had not chosen Hanley. They had just lucked upon him sleeping in his trench. They were a raid party of four, terrified and obedient, and they'd been told to bring back an enemy to serve as an example of what is done to infiltrators. They dragged Hanley back across the line and ran him, with his hands tied behind his back, the 2 kilometers to the general's tent. The general dismissed the guards because he was very taken with Hanley. He untied the cords that bound his wrists and let his arms hang free. Then slowly, ritually, he tipped Hanley's face toward the light and examined it carefully. He kissed him on the brow and on the cheek and finally on the mouth. He gazed deep and long into Hanley's eyes until he saw his own reflection there, looking back. He traced the lines of Hanley's eyebrows gently with the tip of his index finger. "Such a beautiful face," he said in his own language. He pressed his palms lightly against Hanley's forehead, against his cheekbones, his jaw. With his little finger he memorized the shape of Hanley's lips, the laugh lines at his eyes, the chin. The general did Hanley's face very thoroughly. Afterward he did some things down below, and so just before sunrise, when the time came to lead Hanley out to the stripping post, he told the soldiers with the knives, "This young man could be my own son, so spare him here and there." The stripping post stood dead center in the line of barbed wire, only a few meters beyond the range of gunfire. A loudspeaker was set up and began to blare the day's message. "This is what happens to infiltrators. No infiltrators will be spared." And then as troops from both sides watched through binoculars, the enemy cut the skin from Hanley's body, sparing, as the general had insisted, his face and his genitals. They were skilled men, and the skin was stripped off expeditiously, and they hung it, headless, on the barbed wire as an example. They lay Hanley himself on the ground where he could die. He was rescued a little after noon when the enemy, for no good reason, went into sudden retreat. Hanley was given emergency treatment at the field unit, and when they had done what they could for him, they sent him on to the vet's hospital. At least there, they told each other, he will be attended by the saint. It was quite some time before the saint said yes, she would love him. "Not just love me, possess me." "There are natural reluctancies," she said. "There are personal peculiarities," she said. "You will have to have patience with me." "You're supposed to be a saint," he said. So she lay down with him in his bloody bed, and he found great satisfaction in holding the small woman in his arms. He kissed her and caressed her and felt young and whole again. He did not miss his wife and children. He did not miss his skin. The saint did everything she must. She told him how handsome he was and what pleasure he gave her. She touched him in the way he liked best. She said he was her whole life, her fate. And at night, when he woke her to staunch the blood, she whispered how she needed him, how she could not live without him. This went on for some time. The war was over, and the occupying forces had made the general mayor of the capital city. He was about to run for senator and wanted his past to be beyond the reproach of any investigative committee. He wrote Hanley a letter, which he sent through the International Red Cross. "You could have been my own son," he said. "What we do in war is what we have to do. We do not choose cruelty or violence. I did only what was my duty." "I am in love and I am loved," Hanley said. "Why isn't this enough?" The saint was swabbing his chest and belly with blood retardant. "Nothing is ever enough," she said. "I love, but I am not possessed by love," he said. "I want to be surrounded by you. I want to be enclosed. I want to be enveloped. I don't have the words for it, but do you understand?" "You want to be possessed," she said. "I want to be inside you." And so they made love, but afterward he said, "That was not enough. That is only a metaphor for what I want." The general was elected senator and was made a trustee of 3 nuclear arms conglomerates. But he was not well, and he was not sleeping well. He wrote to Hanley, "I wake in the night and see your face before mine. I feel your forehead pressing against my palms. I taste your breath. I did only what I had to do. You could have been my son." "I know what I want," Hanley said. "If I can do it, I will," the saint said. "I want your skin." And so she lay down on the long white table, shuddering, while Hanley made his first incision. He cut along the shoulders, and then down the arms and back up, then down the sides and the legs to the feet. It took him longer than he had expected. The saint shivered at the cold touch of the knife, and she sobbed once at the sight of the blood. But by the time Hanley lifted the shroud of skin from her crimson body, she was resigned, satisfied even. Hanley had spared her face and her genitals. He spread the skin out to dry, and while he waited, he swabbed her raw body carefully with blood retardant. He whispered little words of love and thanks and desire to her. A smile played about her lips, but she said nothing. It would be a week before he could put on her skin. The general wrote to Hanley one last letter. "I can endure no more. I am possessed by you." Hanley put on the skin of the saint. His genitals fitted nicely through the gap he had left, and the skin at his neck matched hers exactly. He walked the corridors and for once left no bloody tracks behind. He stood before mirrors and admired himself. He touched his breasts and his belly and his thighs, and there was no blood on his hands. "Thank you," he said to her. "It is my heart's desire fulfilled. I am inside you. I am possessed by you." And then in the night he kissed her on the brow and on the cheek and finally on the mouth. He gazed deep and long into her eyes. He traced the lines of her eyebrows gently with the tip of his index finger. "Such a beautiful face," he said. He pressed his palms lightly against her forehead, her cheekbones, her jaw. With his little finger he memorized the shape of her lips. And then it was that Hanley, loved, desperate to possess and be possessed, staring deep into the green and loving eyes of the saint, saw that there can be no possession, there is only desire. He plucked at his empty skin and wept. And that story was The Anatomy of Desire by John Leroux, from Sudden Fiction American Short Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. The next story is from the same book, Any Minute Mom Should Come Blasting Through the Door, by David Orden. Mom died in the middle of making me a sandwich. If I had known it was going to kill her, I never would have asked. It never killed her before to make me a sandwich, so why all of a sudden? My dad didn't understand it either. But we don't talk about it too much. We don't talk about it too much at all. Sometimes we try. Sometimes it's just the two of us at dinner and things are almost good. But only sometimes. Most of the time it's different. Most of the time I do things like forget to leave her place out at the table. And then we don't know what to do. Then we don't even try to talk. 3 plates, 3 glasses. The kitchen shines. A bright, shiny kitchen, Mom used to say. And there we are, my dad, her place, and me. And any minute Mom should come blasting through the door, all bundles and boxes, my big winter coat squaring her off at the shoulders and hips, her face smiling and wrinkled like a plant. I should have known better. I should have known about these things. Come on, Mom, what do you say? Is it going to kill you to make me one sandwich? Is it really going to kill you? Remember how you used to play with me? Remember? And then I snuck up behind her chair, undid her curlers, and ran my fingers through her hair until she said, "All right already, what kind did I want?" Then she stood up, turned to my dad, and opened her bathrobe so he could get a peek just to see if the old interest was still there. But I don't think it was. "What?" he said. "He hasn't seen this before?" "Make the sandwich," he said, and he let his body melt like pudding into the easy chair. That was it. That was the last thing he said to her. Mom turned up the TV, went into the kitchen, and the next thing we knew she was calling out for help. Well, my dad didn't know what was going on any more than I did, so he got up from his chair, trudged across the room, making sure to scrape his feet on the carpet all the way so he could really shock her good this time, and that was it. Mom was dead on the floor of the kitchen, her bathrobe open at the waist. And I thought, well, there's Mom dead. What now? No one thinks about that. No one thinks about what happens after you find your mother dead like that, all over the kitchen floor. But I'm telling you, that's when the real fun starts. That's when you have to try mouth to mouth on her, on your mother, for God's sake, knowing that if she does come around, she'll spit up in your face, because that's what happens, but praying for it anyway, because if she doesn't, then it's all over. That's when you've got to call an ambulance and wait for them to throw a sheet over her head so they can take her away from you. That's when you've got to sit there and watch them put their hands all over her body and know they'll never believe you even tried to save her. That's when the neighbors see the flashing red light in your driveway and wonder what kind of rotten son you are that you couldn't save your mother. That's when you've got your whole life to live. and all it's going to be is one excuse after another for why you didn't save her. What do you do? We didn't know, so my dad poured her on the couch, and we waited. We waited and watched TV. It was on. But like I said, we don't talk about it too much. How can we? Mom was a talker. That's what she used to say. She used to say, "Boys, what would you do without me?" And here we are without her. My dad and I wouldn't know how to talk to each other if you paid us, so we don't even try. Not much, anyway. What am I going to say? How's your love life? What's it like to sleep alone? He doesn't want that. He doesn't want that at all. He wants me out of the house. But he doesn't really want that either, you know. What would he do then? 6 rooms can be too many if you're not careful. I tell him this at dinner sometimes. I tell him how much he needs me, how much he cares. But he doesn't care. He cares about the kitchen, the robe, the things I did to try to save his wife, my hands, her body, my lips, her mouth. Tell me, he says, is that really how you want to remember your mother? And that story was Any Minute Mom Should Come Blasting Through the Door by David Orden, from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.